And I'd like to invite Professor David Waters. Although he's speaking on behalf of Australasia, he's worked for 8 years in South Africa. He's familiar with the African context. He was, for 8 years, he worked as a professor of surgery in Papua New Guinea. And he directed the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons managed PNG programs and the Pacific Island programs. So I think it's a very unique perspective. And then he shifted back to really becoming a high-income country surgeon based in Melbourne and Deakin University, and now at the University of Geelong in Australia. And he is the former president of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons, so he's going to give us his perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to share a view from Oceania and the Pacific. And I am speaking on behalf of the Pacific Islands Surgical Association, the Medical and Surgical Societies of Papua New Guinea, and also the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons, Global Health. And just to remind you all that Australasia includes Australia and New Zealand, if there are any New Zealanders in the audience. And this is the area that I'm actually talking about. And the population sizes are all relatively small. And you will see that many of the Pacific Island countries have populations of a few thousand up to a few hundred thousand, with Timor-Leste 1.3 million and Papua New Guinea 8 million. And Papua New Guinea is by far the largest region that our college has direct training and capacity building partnership with 8 million people, and a GDP of only $2,500 per capita. Many of the Pacific Islands have similar or equivalent, and Timor-Leste much lower. Now, what I'd like you to consider is in advocacy for global surgery, and Dr. Jani started us off on this, how successful are we actually being? Well, we're really 5, 6, 7 years into the process of advocating for global surgery and speaking with largely a common voice. And The Economist in April this year at least has managed to devote its front page and a special report to universal health coverage being within reach, and even had a chapter that was really taken out of the Lancet Commission on surgery being the kindest cut. So perhaps we are getting beyond a room full of surgeons who are really already the converted. But we have a great deal of work to do out there in civil society if our messages are really going to get through. But we need to start making sure that surgeons all around the world are speaking on message. So in 2016, after the Lancet Commission launched, the Pacific Island Surgical Association held a conference in Samoa, and where it was really focused on global surgery and what that means for the Pacific. At the same time, Papua New Guinea surgeons asked to organize the following year, 2017's Medical Society Conference, the first time the surgeons have ever done that in over 50 years, and on access to safe, affordable surgery and anesthesia. And they held that symposium, and they got the Prime Minister and the Minister of Health to come to the opening. There's the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, the Honourable Peter O'Neill, and Dr. Pukatemu, who's a physician, as the Minister of Health. And last month, they actually presented their resolution findings, which are all about translating global surgery metrics and planning for surgery into Papua New Guinea's health system. And if we think about how are we going to be successful advocates, and Dr. Jani was speaking to us about this, but Jeremy Shipman, in reviewing the maternal health successful advocacy over many years, broke it down to a framework of four actor power ideas: political context and issue characteristics. So there's no doubt that in Papua New Guinea, and indeed in the Pacific, that we've got the message over to the actors who are the surgical and anesthesia leaders. We're not doing so well in Southeast Asia and in many parts of the world with the obstetric and gynecology leaders, and we do need to do an awful lot more to include them. We also have institutions on board. I can tell you that in my time as president of the RACS, Global surgery was a hot topic all around the meetings of the various presidents, and I'm sure Barbara would say the same thing in the last year. We've got the colleges on board, and in Papua New Guinea last year, we have the president of the Obstetric and Gynecology College, Mark Schreim, who may be in the audience somewhere, was representing Harvard, postgraduate program of surgery and social change, John Batten, the president of RACS, current one, and the president of the Anesthetic College. So they were there on message speaking about global surgery. And there is no doubt, again, that in our advocacy, we've actually got the right ideas. We don't need to change the messages, nor do we really need to change the metrics of the Lancet Commission. The internal frame is right. But if you think about this poor woman in obstructed labor being floated over a flooded river in order to try and reach a first-level hospital in Papua New Guinea, we realize that we haven't got the external frame right. We've still got many parts of our societies in developing countries who don't have access to safe, affordable, and timely surgical and anesthesia care. And we need to see more in the way of public portrayals and get the message over to our external audiences. And we need to ensure that access to safe, affordable surgery is perceived as important by women in the community and by people who influence politicians. And that was being reflected on in the presentation by Dr. Yawe. So we certainly have succeeded in speaking on message with WHO, and Walt Johnson's been a great representative for surgery within WHO. And he was out recently at the Pacific Islands Surgical Association, and surgical collaborating centers are now being established around the world, and that is very, very promising for future research and for advocacy. Let's just think in this external frame of advocacy where we might be failing. Here are our stakeholders, the patients and public, the physicians and the surgeons. Yes, they're probably convinced. The patients and public are only convinced when they and their families are actually in trouble, but I don't think they're in fact a large groundswell and we haven't mobilized civil society. The providers, the health services, are very hard pressed with lots of infrastructural and resource problems, and they're not always focused on delivering access to safe, affordable surgery. The policymakers are not yet writing surgery into their national health plans, and whereas we might convince a few people in the Ministry of Health, we're certainly not succeeding with the people with the purse strings, with the Ministry of Finance. And do we have politicians speaking on message yet? That is the issue for your particular country. So if we continue thinking about the advocacy framework, I would say that number 10, severity, we know it's a big problem. We've got effective and cost-effective interventions, even if we haven't made people believe that. And I'd like to spend the last part of this presentation just thinking about credible indicators, because we really cannot manage what we do not measure. And if in your country the global surgical metrics are not being considered, I would put it to you that probably nobody is really managing it. And it's all talk and aspiration, but without metrics to see how we're going, I do not know how we're going to proceed. So, our story from the Pacific. We have had a collaborative group formed after the Lancet Commission that were given the task of reporting to the 2016 RACS conference, and they managed to look at the first four indicators at that time and presented on the financial ones in 2017. But you can see in the Pacific Islands and in Papua New Guinea and Timor-Leste, access to safe, affordable, and timely surgery is between 20 and about 60%. And I put Zambia and Myanmar on the map there to show where we compare, and only Australia, New Zealand, and one or two countries where you can get everywhere in the country in 10 to 15 minutes because the islands are so small. These places obviously have 100% bellwether access. But what do the bellwethers actually measure? Well, they measure the second delay of transportation. And it can be very difficult to get across the mountains in Papua New Guinea to a first-level hospital, but we don't measure the first delay, how long do people take to decide to travel, even to a hospital, or think that the health system might address their issue? And we don't measure often the third delay of how long people wait to be seen once they actually reach the hospital. And Timor-Leste, 1.3 million people, where only two of the five hospitals actually provide the bellwethers reliably, and where bellwether access is 50%. We looked at this last year, and you can see that for the blue column here, these are people who need a laparotomy. In other words, you only got in the study if you had a laparotomy. They wait 36 hours before they decide to travel to hospital. It then took them about 6 hours to get to hospital, and then about another 10 hours before they got their laparotomy. So 50 plus hours before you get an emergency laparotomy. And you can imagine some of the outcomes would have been compromised. Again, for cesarean section, 17 and a half hours, 3 hours, and pretty quickly if you arrive in hospital and need an emergency seizure. But very interestingly, if you fracture your leg in Papua New Guinea, and you actually travel quite quickly to hospital because you know that nothing else will work, and therefore you start moving yourself to hospital quickly. So there is an opportunity to improve public health. We need to do each of these sort of studies in your own country. How are we going with the global health workforce? Message for politicians: if you invest in a health worker, and we need to invest in a lot more, they will provide a return on investment of 16 to 1. And so if we think about the Pacific health workforce, you can see there that our statistics are largely that many of the countries in the Pacific, Papua New Guinea, are around about 1 to less than 10 surgeon anesthesia or obstetric providers per 100,000. But just giving that number isn't going to convince a politician. What we need to go to the politicians and say, because they are the real stakeholders, is we need to train 248 more specialists for Timor-Leste, or we need to train 796 more specialists for Papua New Guinea. And the metrics allow you to do that and to turn the metric around and say, what do we need to do? What's the solution? In Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, the specialist training program is a four-year training program run by the universities called a Master of Medicine. And it takes doctors who are already been qualified for usually 4 years into training and supervises their training very similar to any other fellowship training program, but they have to write an M.Med. thesis, and their final exams are either in year 3 or 4, depending which university, and a select number of people will become subspecialists afterwards. So that's the training program. We used to have a problem with brain drain, but we no longer have a problem with brain drain. Of 93 Papua New Guinea surgeons trained since 1975, 97% are in the country. And over 80% from the Pacific Islands, and even Fiji, that had a terrible problem with brain drain, they are now being retained at a rate of 80% plus, because we've actually got a local training program that's actually fit for purpose, a broader training program more suited to the health needs of the Pacific, but is not transportable to other countries unless they go over there and sit their fellowship exam. We're also able to look at our population sizes for the various countries and make estimates of the additional surgeons required. And we've looked at the number of surgeons trained and the number of surgeons who are retiring or have died, and we're able to make these sort of estimates for health plans in the Pacific. The Royal Australasian College of Surgeons, as you heard in the introduction, we have a Pacific Islands and a Papua New Guinea, different support programs, but we provide a lot of support for can-do operations that can be saved up by subspecialist teams where many of the countries would not ever be able to train their own subspecialists. And we do about 3,000 consultations and almost 1,000 operations per year through these programs, and they're not focused on service delivery, they're actually focused on capacity building and supporting general surgeons in those countries to doing what they can do in the subspecialty pathologies. Orthopedics is the best developed, and particularly in Papua New Guinea, this is the orthopedic team. They've got the critical mass to train some subspecialists, and here's the head of department, Professor Rikau Kavau, in Port Moresby. If we think about, are we delivering enough operations? Again, we're not. Many of the countries are below 2,000 per 500,000 population against a target of 5,000, but we're able again to go to the ministries and say, this is the deficit, this is what we need to work toward doing. We won't do it overnight, but this is the aim by 2030 to achieve that. Tonga was the first country in the Pacific to really take perioperative mortality rates seriously. And from 2012 onwards, they've reported the perioperative mortality rate. You can see it halved or more in the first year of reporting. And the numbers are very low because Tonga's only got 100,000 people. But Tonga was able to show the rest of the Pacific how to do it. And the former Deputy Prime Minister and former Minister of Health is a surgeon, and he was the one who convinced the whole Pacific to take the Lancet metrics seriously. Perioperative mortality rates in the Pacific vary from the Cook Islands to 0.11, right up to about almost one in Timor-Leste and Southeast Asia, Myanmar. But you can see we're able to report our perioperative mortality rates, and the surgical profession have really taken this on board, and it's given them the routine to the other metrics. So, but what do politicians need to hear? It's one thing to say, my perioperative mortality rate is 0.5%. Well, great, what does that really mean? Well, first of all, we need to say to the politicians, does anyone want to be treated in a hospital that doesn't know whether patients live or die when they leave the hospital? And it's really not acceptable to do an operation if you don't know whether the patients live or die. But a POMR of 0.5% means very little when you can compare it with reports in the literature between 0.2 and 2%. But it does mean something to a politician when you really say, that's 250 deaths for every 1 million people. If you reach 50,000 operations for that million people, and therefore if you can halve your POMR, often by addressing emergency laparotomy, fractured neck of femur and other things, you can save 125 lives per year. And those lives will be economically active, and reducing POMR is good for all stakeholders. We've also shown that it may not be necessary all the time to collect all the metrics because they're actually correlated. This is bellwether access with SAO provider numbers and cases per 100,000 in the Pacific. And so if you're collecting one, they're probably reflective of the other. And the same is true with surgical workforce numbers against surgical volume and perioperative mortality rate. Tonga has shown that in the Pacific, and as have the Solomons and Timor-Leste, that in fact financial catastrophe as a result of surgery in the Pacific is relatively small, probably around about 10%, but 20% in Papua New Guinea and Timor, because the health coverage is very much better than it is perhaps for the poor people that you were mentioning in Brazil. In closing, I'd like just to say that there's going to be great value in getting global metrics out there in maps. Now, the World Federation of Anaesthetists have done very well with their anaesthesia map. This is the map for Southeast Asia. And here's the map for the Pacific that includes the number of physicians and surgeons as well. And what we decided to do in our department with the global surgery metrics for the Pacific is to develop a surgical interactive map. It costs us nothing to do this. You never need to pay for this. All of the software is free on the internet. And you can click here, and if you click on Tonga, you'll see that you get the global surgery metrics for Tonga. And if you click on Fiji, you get those for Fiji. And if you click on Vanuatu, for Vanuatu. And if you click on the Solomon Islands or any of the countries that we've done the global surgery metrics. So we can get this information out there and hopefully available to the ministries of health as well. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that I hope you understand that Oceania, which is very far away from here, takes a long time to get here, is actually very actively engaged in collecting the global surgery metrics and advocating for global surgery. We've got lots of problems of access of our own to solve, but we do support the metrics. Our populations are small, with many people living remotely, but you have an opportunity to test solutions in our small populations because it's much easier to test what's happening in the whole population. And we all need to do an awful lot more to convince stakeholders outside this room that, in fact, our advocacy for global surgery is actually well-meaning, well targeted and actually will bring great financial benefit to the countries. And we need our global, all of our countries, but in Oceania as well, we actually need to go from convincing people with words to them actually investing money in surgical and anesthesia care. Thank you.
Have our all the speakers that come up to the stage, please. We have a few minutes, about 10 minutes for a Q&A. I want to thank you all for really just fabulous and informative lectures. I think we got a lot of important data, a lot of important, very clear statements of the issues, and really some very thoughtful, very wonderful suggestions regarding opportunities for remedy to some of these challenges. I'd sort of like to ask the audience to come forward. Yes, go to the mic and identify yourself, please, and we'll take it from there.
Bragueto from Chile. Chile right now is a middle-income country. However, we have the same problems that was shown here. For example, in Chile, there are high quality of surgery where? In the big cities, in the university, a hospital and private clinic. However, in the rural environment, is the same reality that we show here. And I agree with all of the ideas that Marcelo present here. The big problem for our country is the access of the people to this the high quality center. And I saw the idea that suggested by Marcelo Ribeiro is use the military system, because in Chile, when earthquake, you know that in Chile there are very often earthquake, the government take the military system and put together with the other hospital to solution for the trauma patient in the rural situation. This is a big idea, and I agree all of the other comments here. Thank you.
Comments, thoughts, anybody?
I think Chile is first of all, it's an amazing country, great wine, and bad thing is the situation in Chile is much better, because it's a kind of well-distribution situation geographically, comparing to Brazil and etc. I think, my personal opinion, that Chile have one of the best health systems in South America today. And even though you see Dr. Bragueto just presented, that there is still difficulties. So it's, I think, one of the biggest challenges geographically. I mean, everything is so big there, this distance and etc. But thank you for your comments, Dr. Bragueto.
So my comment would only be that wherever you have inequities of access, governments will only respond if there are actually metrics that actually identify who the people are who are suffering and who have lack of access. So I think it's really important in an individual country where there's high standards and low standards all across the country, like there are in many Southeast Asian countries as well, to map that so that the government actually can see the differences and therefore will have no choice but to respond to it eventually.
Was that mapping done within the surgery? Who does that mapping? How do you get that data?
Oh, the mapping that, I don't know who did the WFSA mapping, but the mapping that I showed you is done by one of the postdocs in my department, but it's free. And anyone who wants to map, we're very happy to send you how we did it with Google Docs and Paint. It's very simple, but it gets the information out there. And once it's on the internet, they can't put it away. It's not fake news.
Dr. Kersey.
I've heard no mention of non-physician clinicians as being a support group for many of the countries that are still capacity building. I've worked in Tanzania for several years in the past, and they provide a significant unmet need in the rural areas. Their statistics in terms of the procedures they do are relatively few, cesarean sections, hernias, but they compare favorably with the MD equivalent surgery, the high-tech needs are not necessarily the most important aspect of their care. In some ways, if we could duplicate what we did 50 years ago in our Western countries, we'd have a significant success rate. So this is a group that in several countries, Tanzania, Zambia, Mozambique, are very effective and will bridge this generation to provide surgical care closer to the population in need.
Thank you very much. So this is something we found very necessary to do in West Africa. And we began to train, we are not training non-doctor physicians, but we're training doctors and giving orientation to those who are running some of the small hospitals in the rural areas. This is very important in Ghana, where they have trained them to be able to do hernias, do emergency cesarean sections, and so on and so forth. It works so well that some of these level of doctors do not want to come back again for any further training. They just satisfy working in the community in that regard. The second thing is that as a training program itself, we have now included a rural surgery training for the residents. And every hospital to have a full accreditation must have at least one or two of those kind of hospitals very far away from the city center, from the town. So that at least some level of good quality care can still be given to those in rural areas. The third area we have tried to exploit is to send medical teams on a fairly regular basis. You've seen the politicians who would like to come back again for the next 10 of elections, and we ask them to sponsor surgical outreaches to such medical outreaches. So they promote their name, and then we're able to offer services to the society.
Sorry if I was not clear, but in one of my slides, I mentioned about the numbers of surgeons, the maldistribution of surgeons, and task shifting. When I was talking about task shifting, it was about non-physician providers being used. But I think task shifting, task sharing have been discussed quite a bit. I just want to clarify one thing. What we're beginning to realize at the present moment in the surgical arena is that has to be an appropriate task sharing. In countries where there are no doctors, for example, in Malawi, there are not enough doctors, you'll have non-physician providers compulsorily do cesarean sections. In Kenya, where doctors are available, the Ministry of Health will not allow them to do cesarean sections because we know of the problems. The technical procedure of doing a cesarean section is not the issue. The issue is making a decision whether a CS is required or not. So those are some of the things that have been highlighted over the last few years. There are obviously areas where task shifting has to take place, but I think it has to be contextual and appropriate. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. We're going to have to get out of the room, unfortunately. So Dr. Tafara, who I think most of you know, leads our Operation Giving Back program here at the college.
Well, thank you. An amazing panel, and so there's so much information shared. I just wanted to ask David to explain a little bit more. Without metrics, without some measurement we put, we can't even check our progress. So it's really critical we do those metrics and implement them. Can you tell us a little bit more about the logistics? How does it get operationalized? Is this an internet database? Do all fit in the same place? So how is it really done? Because that is, I think, where the challenges are for most people to understand. And maybe I just want to hear also from our other surgical colleges to see if there are some data points that are being collected and how are they collected so that things can be measured. So thank you.
Well, I think the first thing was abuse of presidential power because when I was president, I said I expected in 6 months' time at an international symposium all of the representatives to present their data. And how my then associate professor, who's since become professor, no connection between the advancement, but he got a group of people together from the Pacific. Each country had its own representative who got their own local data. They had regular talks on the telephone to try and establish the methodology, because the Lancet Commission wasn't as clear as we probably should have been about how to collect the metrics, and what do you put into the pool of surgical volume, for example, is really challenging. Do you include local anesthesia procedures? Do you miss out cataracts? Do you put them in? Do you do endoscopies? And so they standardized all that, and they also had to adopt different methods of bellwether access mapping for each country, because just drawing a map around, a contour around in hilly country doesn't really work. And if you're talking about how long does it take a ferry to go from one island to another. So you need a lot of local knowledge, which is much more accurate than sitting somewhere in North America doing this with Google Maps or with satellite images. So that's something about the process, but it was very collaborative, and there was a representative from every single country adopting a standard methodology and or a standard agreement and consensus about some of the snags about how to collect the metrics.
Very good. Okay, last question, and then we'll close this wonderful session.
Emmanuel, I'm from Nigeria. Some of the speakers pointed out it's important that we get all the leadership of the various specialties together to be able to speak with one voice. But from experience, it's easy to do this at the various regional college levels, but at country levels, where the work needs to get done, this has proved very difficult, especially with getting our obstetrics colleagues, their leadership, for everybody to come together to speak with one voice. So how best can we achieve this?
If you look at the setup in Africa, and Nigeria is in Africa, so we're talking the same language, at the ministry level, there are people who are designated to look after the various specialities and subspecialities. I think that is where to start, at the ministry level. You'd have somebody who's in charge of looking at anesthesia. We have head of specialist services, then anesthesia, OBGYN, and all the others. So that's where to start. And then you go to the surgical associations, which are existing in the country. We have the Kenya Orthopedic Association, the Surgical Society of Kenya. They will then get these players on the ground. You have a meeting, and then you talk with one voice. That is the most important thing, because otherwise what happens is, as my friend here alluded, politicians have very little time and understand a different language, and we don't know how to speak that language. So if we get to talk with one voice, that is the way we get our message across. Is that clear? Did I answer my question? Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, I want to thank my co-moderator as well as these wonderful presentations and for your service and commitment to bringing some solutions to these really pressing needs. I'm grateful to have everyone here, and keep up the good work, and let's keep going, huh? Thank you so much. Thank you.